Lecture 6, Product Liability.
Greetings. We're going to be talking about product liability, how you recover if you're injured by a product that you've purchased from someone else. And the modern rule is one of strict product liability. If you recall, we talked about how strict liability means that liability even without proof of negligence or an intentional act. Let me begin by telling you a little bit about how the law of product liability evolved. First, you could bring a product liability case in the old days if you were injured under negligence, but it might be hard to prove negligence. Moreover, a product might be defective even without negligence. Some products might just be unavoidably defective. So negligence was not a great opportunity to recover when you're harmed by a product. Now, there was another way you could recover, and that was under the law of warranty. When someone sells you a product, they may make to you several forms of warranties. They may make an express warranty. They may promise to you that this product is of top quality. They may also make some implied warranties. The law of the sale of goods contracts, Uniform Commercial Code, says that almost all sales are accompanied by a warranty of merchantability, an implied warranty of merchantability. That is, that the goods you're buying are of at least average, acceptable quality for their purpose. So you could sue for a breach of warranty if you bought some goods that were clearly defective. But warranty had its problems too. Some defects might not violate the implied warranty of merchantability. Plus, there was another problem. To sue under warranty or any other contract cause of action, you needed privity of contract, which means you needed to be a party to the contract. This means if your neighbor is out mowing his lawn, the blade comes off the lawnmower, levitates over to your yard, and cuts off your finger. Well, that wasn't a very good lawnmower, but can you sue under warranty? No, because you didn't buy the lawnmower. You lacked the privity of contract with the manufacturer who made the defective lawnmower. So out of these limits, strict liability evolved. Strict liability doesn't apply to everything in the world. We have a very limited case here. Where you have a sale of a product by a merchant, then there is strict liability. If you buy a product from a big retailer, that product is defective, and that product harms you, you can sue the retailer and the manufacturer of the product in strict product liability. It's somewhat easier to recover, but it's no guarantee you'll recover just because you're hurt by a product. That's what we're going to talk about today. What are the requirements to recover under strict product liability? We'll start with protected interests. What interests are protected in strict product liability? The first one and the main one is personal injury. You're protected from personal injury. So if you buy a product that causes you a physical injury, that's covered in strict product liability. If you buy a lawnmower and it cuts your foot off, that's a physical injury that you're protected under. You also may be protected for property damage, but there's a distinction made here between property damage and economic loss. There is no strict product liability for economic loss. So if you buy a product that malfunctions that causes you economic loss, you'd have to win in negligence or something like that. You can't win in strict product liability. But physical damage, maybe. Here's the distinction. Go back to our defective lawnmower. If you have a lawn mowing business and your lawnmower breaks down because of a defect, can you sue in strict product liability for all the business you lost, all the unmowed lawns? No. That's economic damage. On the other hand, if your lawnmower flies off and chops down somebody's garage, well, that's economic, too. I mean, it's not a physical harm to the person. But that's a kind of property damage where you may be able to recover in strict product liability. Okay, so those are the protected interests. So what if you suffer one of those kind of harms? As I said, most of them are physical harms to your body, injuries to yourself. What do you have to do to recover in strict product liability? First, you have to show that there was a defective product, that the product you bought was defective. Some products can cause harm without being defective. So you have to show the product was defective. You don't have to show negligence But you have to show the product was defective. Well, what's the difference? Why is it easier for me to show the product is defective than negligence? Well, it's a lot easier. It can be. Because in order to show negligence, you would have to show that at some point in the manufacture of that product, someone was careless and made the defect. In order to cover under strict products liability, you only need to take the end product. You focus on the status of the product and show that that product contained a defect. And you don't care how it got there. You don't have to show how it got there. If it had a defect, you can recover. Now, there are several different kinds of defects. The kind of defect that you probably springs to mind, that you think of most, is a manufacturing defect. A defective manufacturing process. If a car is going along the old assembly line there in Michigan, and they forget to put the brakes in, that's a manufacturing defect. If you were injured because you get in the car, you're ready to go, you come to the first stoplight, you move your foot over to where there should be, there's not even a brake pedal there, that's a manufacturing defect. You can recover. That's an obvious kind of defect, the easiest kind of defect. But there's a second kind of defect that's increasingly common, at least lawsuits about it are increasingly common, and that's a design defect. A design defect. This is where the manufacturing process may have gone perfectly. All those good blue-collar guys on the assembly line did their job to a T. But the product, there was a flaw backed by the white-collar guys in the main office when they were designing the product. They designed the product in a way that made it unsafe. Well, what would that be? I mean, there are some obvious examples that should come to mind, such as in the case of cars. You've heard of the Ford Pinto case, I suppose, where because of the placement and nature of the gas tank, when the car was hit from behind, it caused a big explosion and fire. Well, that was not a manufacturing defect. It was supposed to be there. The people in the assembly line put it right where it was supposed to be. But it was a design defect. It was unsafe to design it so as to be put in that place. And again, there's a big dispute with GM and the side. I really don't know the truth of that, but maybe it was a defect for GM to put the gas tank on the side where side impact collisions could cause it to trigger. These are design defects. These are another kind of defect that would enable you to sue the company. Okay, there's a third kind of defect that, again, is a more common recent source of litigation, and that is failure to warn. Failure to warn. It may be that there is no manufacturing defect. The product was manufactured perfectly correctly, and there is no design defect. This was the best possible design for the product. But yet it could still be defective because of failure to warn. Well, what should they warn about? Sometimes the product itself is the best that it can be, but there is still a danger there that the ordinary person would not perceive. And the manufacturer has a duty to warn of that danger so the ordinary person is aware of its presence. Think about a drug case. If you have a drug, it's important, you need it for your health, but it has a little thing on there warning you about the side effects. So you can make the judgment when you're taking that drug whether you want to, whether you want to risk taking it at all or whether you want to take this much, because you've been warned about the side effects. And the failure to warn of the presence of those side effects can be a defect. It's treated as a defect just like a design defect or a manufacturing defect. Well, failure to warn, if you think about it, could get sort of out of hand. Could be pretty broad, because any given product can, to a really creative person, be thought of causing many, many different harms. When do you have to warn about a product? Do you have to warn about every conceivable thing that might happen? A thermos might be overpressured and explode. A thermos might break and little pieces might chip and put your eye out. Do you have to warn about all that sort of thing? No, not necessarily. In determining a failure to warn claim, the extent to which you must warn, the courts consider a couple of factors. First, they consider the extent of the risk. You don't have to warn about every conceivable risk that might happen to one person once in 1,000 years. What we want to know is we want to look at the number of people who are likely to be affected. How often is this likely to happen? How frequent is the occurrence of harm? If it's frequent, you may have to warn about it. If it's very rare and unlikely, you may not. The courts will also consider the extent of the harm, the extent of the harm caused. If this accident is likely to cause very little harm, a paper cut. Now, you've bought a big ream of paper, I suppose, from time to time, and you don't see a lot of warnings on that, do you? Now, we all know you can get a paper cut. I've gotten quite a few in my lifetime. There's no warning about that. Can I sue them? This paper was defective. You didn't warn me that I might get this nasty, painful, though not exactly life-threatening, paper cut. Now, they don't have to warn about something like that because even though it's frequent, it's not too severe. Plus, most people probably already know about it. On the other hand, some other people have sort of gone overboard with warnings. I'm told that a ladder today is literally covered with warnings on every open inch, and that's probably a little bit silly. I don't think many people read those. I mean, warnings like don't stand on the top step, things that people should know. I think that's a little bit overboard, but, you know, maybe some excessive litigation caused that. I don't know. But when you're deciding whether you have a duty to warn, you first have to consider the extent of the risk, both in terms of frequency and in terms of severity. But just putting a warning on doesn't necessarily satisfy your obligations under product liability. Not just any warning is not necessarily enough. The courts also look at the conspicuity of the warning. The conspicuity of the warning. How conspicuous is this warning? Is it enough to truly apprise a person of the nature of the risk? And I'm sure you see this all the time on television advertisements where somebody puts up an advert, you know, great car, and then they have these eight lines of tiny print that flash across the screen for an instant. There may be a warning in there, but I don't know because I can't read it. Likewise, on the product itself, you'll find some products, particularly small products, where there isn't a lot of room, you know, where the warning is so tiny, you can't really, you have to make a big effort. You may need a magnifying glass even to read it. Well, those sort of warnings are not necessarily satisfactory. Courts will look at where the warning is placed. Is the warning placed at a site where you're likely to see it? Or is it obscured somewhere where you may never look on the product? They'll look at how big the print is. If it's an important warning, if it's a real significant risk, you'd better have it all capital letters in bigger print so that people are sure to see it. I mean, the truly nerdy, reasonable person, perhaps, would read all the fine print on every product before it was purchased. But most of us aren't like that. Most of us maybe skim it. Some people don't look at it at all, but if you get a product and it's covered with warning, covered with discussion, some of which may be warnings, you probably don't read every last word. If you do, that's good, but most people don't. And the manufacturers of the products should be aware of that, and they should highlight the important parts, particularly significant warnings. And then another feature in failure to warn is what the warning says. What does the warning say? This matters. I mean, it's not enough to give a warning that's insufficient. If your product will cause cancer, you'd better say it will cause cancer. Just saying it might cause cancer, that may not be a good enough warning. Well, what warnings are best known today? I suspect the warnings that are best known to you all is the warnings on packs of cigarettes. And Congress, those warnings are dictated by the federal government, and Congress has gone back and forth on what those warnings should say. And actually, this is a bit of irony. Many of you may well be aware that the cigarette companies have been sued in product liability. Smokers, lifetime smokers, have died, and their heirs or survivors, or they themselves, when they're in the terminal stages of cancer, have brought suit against the cigarette companies and said, this is a defective product. Well, under what theory is it a defective product? It's not a manufacturing defect, in all probability. Most cigarettes are exactly the way they're supposed to be. Some people have some arguments that there's a defect in the tobacco or something, but mainly, they're the way they're supposed to be. Is it a design defect? Well, I don't know. That one's a little tricky. You might be able to argue it in some cases if, you know, it didn't have a filter. Maybe that's a design defect, but that's a little tricky. Well, the obvious and best product liability claim against a cigarette manufacturer is failure to warn. And this would be a killer. The tobacco industry would be totally bankrupt today because of this failure to warn claim. Because let's face it, the evidence is overwhelming that cigarettes cause lung cancer, emphysema, heart disease, and other problems as well. And the cigarette companies have maintained for years, and still to some degree to this day, that it doesn't cause these things and would never have put a warning on their own packages. So the cigarette companies would be dead today, but guess what happened back in the 1960s? Congress thought it was getting tough. Congress insisted that they put a specific warning on the cigarette packages. And you know what that did? That took away the claims of all those potential product liability plaintiffs who wanted to sue for damages caused by cigarette smoking. Because now there is an adequate warning, and it's adequate as a matter of law. Congress said this was adequate. Courts are not going to second-guess Congress on something like that. So not only is there a warning, but it's a definitionally, legally sufficient warning. So that failure to warn claim is gone. And what's more, the warning hurts any other claim you might have, because now you've been informed of the risk. Now you might think everybody knows cigarettes are unsafe. Well, most people do today, but at one point people didn't. But that warning informed them that cigarettes were unsafe, so they might be held to have assumed the risk of any harm from cigarette smoking they might have. So, although the cigarette companies at the time were somewhat resistant to this warning, it saved them, I think. So a warning can be a very valuable thing to your company. If your company causes a risk, you'd better put a warning on there, or you're going to be subject to a lot of disastrous product liability litigation. Okay, well, that's the topic of defect. And that's the first thing you have to show to recover under strict product liability. You have to show a defect. But you must show a second important thing as well. And that is that the defect makes the product unreasonably dangerous. That the defect makes the product unreasonably dangerous. What is unreasonably dangerous? Well, that's a good question, and that's pretty debatable. The courts tend to use what's called a balancing test. They consider the danger from the product against the benefit from the product. But you also have to consider alternatives. If there was an easy and cheap alternative way of designing it, then it's unreasonably dangerous. But this unreasonably dangerous issue is kind of a tricky one and not an easy one to resolve. I think we could say that an automobile without doors is unreasonably dangerous. What about an automobile without seat belts? At one time, that was considered okay. But today, I think the sale of an automobile without seat belts would be unreasonably dangerous. What about an automobile without airbags? Well, there's an argument that that might be unreasonably dangerous, too. But I think a court might find that, well, you balance the benefit of the airbag against the cost, which is not inconsiderable against the automobile company. At some point, you have to decide, because we cannot live in a risk-free world, people, as much as we might want. There are going to be dangers out there. Dangers that can be protected against, but that will cost an enormous amount of money to protect against. And we can't expect to spend all that money to protect against every danger. Some people couldn't afford it. What if, you know, have you heard of the Humvee, which was the primary vehicle in Desert Storm? Very sturdy vehicle, you know, low center of gravity, strong body panels, very safe. Now, we could say that we want our cars to be very safe, and therefore it's going to be unreasonably dangerous to build anything short of this Humvee. But you know what that thing retails for? Well, it started out at least at about $100,000. Do we want to make cars so safe that it costs $100,000? Well, I think not. I mean, people need cars, and a lot of people out there can't afford a $100,000 car. So there's got to be a balancing here, and that balancing is used in the unreasonably dangerous test. Well, there are some other tricky parts to the unreasonably dangerous test, and one is the area of what are called unavoidably unsafe products. Unavoidably unsafe products. Consider a knife. Consider a very sharp cooking knife. That is very likely to hurt you. I mean, it's very likely to hurt me, I tell you that much. You know, I'm in there chopping things, and I've cut myself from time to time on these knives. Should I sue the knife manufacturer for product liability? Because after all, I suffered a harm, a physical harm from this product. by cutting myself with a knife. Can I recover that? No. This is unavoidably unsafe. The whole purpose of the knife is to cut things. If you make the knife so blunt, so extremely blunt, that it won't cut my finger, it won't cut anything else either. It'll be a useless product. So that unavoidably unsafe product is not an unreasonably dangerous product. So you can't sue because you cut yourself on your kitchen knife. And another exception is known unsafe products. Known, if it's widely known that a product is unsafe, it's not likely to be unreasonably dangerous because we assume that people have appreciated the danger here and have affirmatively decided to accept that danger when they use that product. And the best example here, I suppose, is a tobacco product. I mean, I think that's well known. It's well known that cigarettes now are dangerous. There was even one recent study that showed that most people think cigarettes are even more dangerous than they actually are, which is pretty bad. So most people know that. That's a known unsafe product, and it's much harder to argue in a case like that a known unsafe product is an unreasonably dangerous product. Okay, but if you've got a defect and you've got an unreasonably dangerous product, you've got a good chance of suing someone for product liability. Well, who? Who do you sue? Well, the liable parties here are quite broad. You can sue the manufacturer of the product because the manufacturer, after all, bears the ultimate responsibility for the state of the product. And if there's a defect, it's probably the fault of the manufacturer. So you can sue the manufacturer, which coincidentally and conveniently also happens to be a pretty deep pocket in most cases. You could also sue the retailer. You can sue the retailer of the product, the person, the store from which you bought the product, because they're supposed to monitor the safety of the products they sell. You can sue them, too. So, product liability, it's not necessarily easy to prove that it has a defect that makes the product unreasonably dangerous, but if you do, you're most of the way home. You've made the basis for your recovery in strict product liability. There are some defenses, however. There are some important defenses to strict product liability. Strict liability does not mean that the defendant automatically loses, although I know some defendants who feel that way. It doesn't. What are some defenses to strict product liability? First, alteration. If the product has been altered after it left the hands of the manufacturer, you can hardly hold the manufacturer responsible for a defect that exists in that product. If I buy a car, a nice little peaceful little car, and I then have the car souped up by having my mechanic replace the engine and do all sorts of other mysterious car things that I don't understand. So I have it souped up so it's completely changed. It goes very, very fast. And then there's a defect in the engine. The engine cuts out or something and I get in an accident. Can I sue the manufacturer? Of course not. That would be terribly unfair. I was significantly altered from the time that I left the hands of the manufacturer and the retailer. So I cannot very well sue the manufacturer in that case. It's not the manufacturer's fault that there's this defect there. That's one defense. Alteration. A second defense is assumption of risk. We've talked about this already in the case of negligence, and the same sort of assumption of risk principles apply in the case of strict product liability. I can't very well go sue over a product, an unreasonably dangerous, defective product, if I knew that and I chose to assume the risk. What about comparative negligence? Remember, we talked about in the negligence discussion how my recovery for your negligence will be reduced, offset, by my own negligence, my own dumb fault in getting into the accident. Should that apply in product liability cases? Well, courts are troubled by this one because comparative negligence is tricky because you don't have to show any negligence on the part of the manufacturer, right? You only have to show a defect. So how do you balance a manufacturer's defect against the negligence of the injured plaintiff? It's tough to do, and some courts have said it shouldn't be done. This is not a negligence issue, but some courts have tried to do it. So this is a state-by-state thing, the extent to which courts will consider the negligence of the individual injured party against the seriousness of the defect in the product. Okay, there's another defense that is unique, specific to product liability, and that is product misuse. You can't very well recover for a product if you're misusing it, and that misuse is the cause of the injury. Doesn't that make sense? But some misuse may still permit you to recover. Well, why is that? Some misuse is foreseeable. If the manufacturer makes a product, it's obviously designed for a given use, but the manufacturer knows darn well some people are going to misuse it, are going to use it more broadly than they're supposed to, then the manufacturer may be liable. for that foreseeable misuse. Let me give you an example. The manufacturer sells you a chair. You've bought a chair from this manufacturer. The first thing you do is sit down in this chair that you just bought from the manufacturer. And the next thing that happens is the chair splinters and collapses. And you fall to the ground and you injure yourself because the chair fell. Do you have a good product liability case? I should think so. I mean, chairs are not supposed to collapse when you sit in them. And if you hurt yourself because this chair was defective, it must have had a manufacturing defect or perhaps a design defect if it fell, if it collapsed just when you sat in it. Okay, change the facts. What if you stand on the chair to change a light bulb? Now, you stand on the chair to change a light bulb, and the chair collapses, the chair shatters beneath you. Standing on a chair, for a variety of reasons, puts greater PSI on specific parts of the chair and makes it more likely to collapse. So, should you be able to recover for your injuries when the chair collapsed beneath you after you stood in the chair to change a light bulb? Well, the manufacturer is going to argue that's product misuse. Chairs are for sitting in, not standing in. Didn't your mama teach you that? Didn't your mother tell you not to stand up in the chair? Don't play with your food and don't stand up in the chair. Well, that manufacturer might still very well be liable, because I think that would fall within the category of foreseeable misuse. Most manufacturers of chairs are aware that from time to time, someone's going to stand on that chair to try and reach something at a high bookshelf or such. And since that misuse is foreseeable, the manufacturer cannot escape liability there for product misuse. And if the manufacturer knows that its chair can't stand up to that, what should it do? It should at least place a warning, a prominent warning on the chair saying, you may have stood up in a lot of chairs in your time, but don't stand up in this one. It's going to collapse on you. Okay? Now, but standing on the chair, you might still be able to recover because any misuse was foreseeable. Now let's say you take that same chair and you hook it up into some sort of elaborate bedroom trapeze operation for reasons that known only to you. But you hook it up into an elaborate trapeze in your bedroom and, you know, it's connected to all that. And in the course of using the chair in this elaborate bedroom trapeze apparatus, the chair collapses and you or whoever's sitting in it falls down and hurts yourself. In that case, can you recover in product liability? I think there the case is almost certainly no. But that was a product misuse. But the chair manufacturer could not foresee that his chair would be put to such a fantastic use. And so the chair's collapse there is not evidence of a defect, and that would be product misuse, and you probably could not recover. One more defense to talk about before we get to the cases. And this defense is called the Learned Intermediary Doctrine. The Learned Intermediary Doctrine finds its primary use in one circumstance, that is, drugs and doctors. You go to a doctor. The doctor prescribes for you a certain drug. You take that drug and you suffer some significant side effects. You are not happy about suffering these significant side effects, so you want to sue. Now, who do you sue? Well, you could sue your doctor. But to win against your doctor, you'd have to prove malpractice, which would involve proving a lot of negligence, and it would be more difficult to do. You want to sue the drug manufacturer, preferably, because there you have the benefit of strict liability, strict product liability. You don't have any against the doctor, but you do against the drug manufacturer. So you want to sue the drug manufacturer. Well, the law permits the manufacturer to interpose as a defense the learned intermediary doctrine. That is because the doctor, the physician, is considered to be a learned intermediary. The manufacturer of the drug is protected from a lawsuit by a patient because the drug manufacturer was relying on the learned intermediary, and reasonably so relying, to limit the use of that drug to the appropriate patients. So in that case, the manufacturer is protected. That's another defense. Okay, let's talk about some cases. We haven't talked about enough cases. The first case is an interesting one. It's the Bubble Yum Baby case. I like this one. The Bubble Yum Baby case. Someone produced a toy called the Bubble Yum Baby. And this was supposed to be a baby that blows bubble gum. Okay? Very realistic. Well, how did it do that? Well, you got a balloon, and you put a balloon in the baby's doll's little mouth, and then by pumping the arm or something, you pumped up the balloon, and it looked like the baby was very nice. Here's the problem. The balloons were detachable. A child took the balloon, was able to detach the balloon from Bubble Yum Baby, and swallowed it. And a balloon is not a safe thing for a child to swallow. And the child died. So the parents sued the manufacturers of Bubble Yum Baby, saying that this, they should be liable in strict product liability for unreasonably dangerous defect. Well, analyze that for a moment in your head and tell me what you think about it. What do you think? Is this a case of strict product liability? I think there's a reasonably good case that it is for strict product liability. The manufacturer should have been aware. They're selling this product to very young children. Of course, eating the balloon is product misuse, but I think it's pretty clearly foreseeable product misuse when you're selling it to small children. The defect would be that the balloon was there and available and detachable, easy for a child to swallow. And as for unreasonably dangerous, well, there is a risk there, and I'm not sure there's any great benefit to having the balloon be detachable. There's some benefit to the baby, but why do you have to have the balloon be detachable? Well, of course, the reason that the balloon is detachable is that after a time, balloons break, or you want to change colors or something like that. That's why they did it, I'm sure. The court, though, disagreed with the plaintiff, said the manufacturer wins. The manufacturer of Bubble Yum Baby wins. Because the court thought about this case and said what this case really comes down to is whether a balloon, a simple balloon, is unreasonably dangerous. Because after all, that was the product, the part of the product, that actually caused the harm. And it's thought that if we say that Bubble Yum Baby is a defective product, aren't we essentially ruling that all balloons that might be sold to children are themselves inherently dangerous products? And while they are somewhat dangerous, it's sort of an unavoidably dangerous situation here, too, because I'm not sure what you can do to a balloon to make it. You could add some huge expensive contraption so it couldn't be swallowed, but it's hard to say. So the court said basically what this case comes down to is a balloon sold to a young child, an unreasonably dangerous defect, and the court would not find that. The court said no. And of course, it was terribly sad about the child, but sometimes these things happen and there is no legal remedy. It was not an unreasonably dangerous defective product, Bubble Yum Baby. Okay, let me give you another case. It illustrates a different principle that we've not talked too much about. A fellow named Greenman, who probably liked to watch that home improvement show with Tim Allen, got for Christmas a big, elaborate combination power tool, fancy product, that could be used as a saw, could be used as a drill, and could be used as a wood lathe, you know, to lathe wood. Okay, so he used it, and he used it a lot, and he had great fun using it. Well, after he'd owned it for more than a year, and he'd used it quite a bit, a piece of wood flew out of the lathe attachment and inflicted severe injuries upon him. He sued the manufacturer of this power tool for strict product liability. Should he be able to recover? Well, he was clearly injured by this product, but some of you may be thinking, what about the fact that he'd owned it and used for more than a year and used it extensively? Don't products really wear down? Does a manufacturer have to be held liable for the inescapable wearing down of their product over the years? Well, courts are not so unreasonable. Courts do take into account the fact that products are going to wear down and become less good over the years. I mean, eventually if you have a car, your brakes will go out. Does that mean you can sue the manufacturer for a defect? No, because it's just not possible to build a car that the brakes don't go out, or reasonably possible to build a car where the brakes don't go out at a certain time. The manufacturer said the same thing in this case. This was a good, safe power tool when we sold it, but these things, after a certain amount of use, are going to wear down. But it didn't work. Greenman won. He was able to recover. Why? Because he was able to produce actual evidence that there was a defective design in the power tool from the day he bought it. And specifically, he noted that there were certain inadequate screws. Certain of the screws that were supposed to hold things together were not adequate, were not strong enough. So, this illustrates the general principle that the courts will acknowledge the reality that products wear down over time, but also that you can still sue after a certain amount of time if you can demonstrate that the harm you suffered was due to a design defect that was in the product at the time you bought it, and not the result of an alteration that you made or the alterations made by time, wear, and use. Okay, here's another one. This is kind of an interesting one, I think. Vincer against Esther Williams swimming pools. We've talked about the in-ground pools a little. This was an above-ground pool. You see these advertised a lot. I've never actually been in one, but these above-ground pools are a bit cheaper, right? And they're big. You know, you have these big above-ground pools. They've got a side wall that's several feet high, and that's filled with water, and you swim in it. And the way you get into these is by climbing up a little ladder on the side, and then at the top of the pool, there's a deck. There's a little decked-in area with a little gate, and so it's usable sort of like a pool. You climb up the ladder. You may not be able to dive, but you go up on the deck, and you can jump in and swim around. Okay, great. Problem, though, anytime you have a swimming pool, you run the risk that a child will inadvertently stray into the pool, a child that is incapable of swimming, and the child will drown and die. So a manufacturer of these pools will have to take certain precautions, certain safety precautions, to prevent that from happening. Now, there may be some of you out there saying, well, it's not some parent's responsibility, it's not the manufacturer's responsibility. Well, you can believe that if you want, but the law thinks the manufacturer should take some responsibility. Parents, if you've been one, cannot keep an eye on their children every second of every minute of every hour of every day. But the Esther Williams swimming pools did take some precautions, and their main precaution was to make the ladder down the side retractable, so that instead of being a solid built-in ladder that stayed there all the time, it was, I don't know, some sort of rope ladder or something that could be let down when you wanted to climb into the pool, but when you were through, you could put the ladder back up on top, right? And that presumably would keep the pool reasonably child-proof, child-safe, because a child of that young an age, you know, couldn't scramble up the wall of the pool and get in anyway. So they thought they were safe. Well, what happened was somebody bought one of these pools. They were using it, and they left the ladder down. I mean, that's an easy thing to do. You just don't think. They left the ladder down. And a child climbed up and got on the deck. There was a little gate on the deck, but the gate had no latch. So the child could just push through the gate and did so and fell in the pool and drowned. The parents sued the manufacturers of the pool, and they argued that had the Esther Williams Swimming Pool Company put a little latch on that gate, the child never could have got through it, couldn't have unlatched the gate, it's a very young child, and would still be alive today. And they said the product was unreasonably dangerous, had a design defect because of a non-latching gate. What do you say? Court says no, manufacturer wins. Manufacturer wins. The manufacturer took a reasonable precaution with respect to the ladder. Manufacturers are not expected to foresee every conceivable problem. The owners have some responsibility here. Because the manufacturer took that sufficient precaution, and because of the general fact that, you know, parents are supposed to have some responsibility too, the court said we're not going to hold them liable in strict products liability. We're not going to find this an unreasonably dangerous defect. Okay, I've got to talk about a whole set of interesting cases that often involve food and like products, because there are all sorts of interesting food cases. People have found all sorts of interesting things in products that aren't really supposed to contain that sort of thing. I mean, some of the classic cases involve, you know, rat droppings in corn chips. That's a good one. There was a severed human thumb once found in a can of chewing tobacco. It's really not supposed to be in there. I mean, I'd just about as soon put a thumb in my mouth as chewing tobacco, but for many other people, that's not the case, okay? So and in some of these cases, people sue for damages. My favorite case is the Blue Ship Tea Room case. Now, this occurred in the days before strict liability. This is an old case, but a woman in Boston went into the Blue Ship Tea Room and she wanted some fish chowder, or as they say, chowder. So she wanted some chowder, and she got some chowder, codfish chowder, and the fish came in chunks, and she ate some of this chowder, and there was a fish bone left in the fish, and she swallowed it, and it blocked her intestinal passage, and she had to undergo an esophagoscopy. I don't know even what the Boston accent would be for esophagoscopy, but she had to undergo one. And this was fairly serious. and she sued the Blue Ship Tribune. This was before the days of strict product liability, so she sued them for warranty, and she lost. It was held that, you know, this is a risk. Any good New Englander should know that fish chowder. The court actually went into great detail and included some recipes in its opinion, which is kind of different. But fish chowder, properly made, has chunks of fish. And the court reasoned that if you're going to have a chunk of fish, you're going to run the risk of having a bone in that chunk of fish. And that's an unavoidable risk. In fact, the court sort of lectured that if we are to take perfect precautions to keep the bones out of fish, we would have to mush up the fish. And we would turn our beloved native chowder into some insipid broth, the court said. And we wouldn't want to do that. So she lost. There are lots of other cases, though. And courts started off by using, in product liability, too, by using what was called the natural versus artificial rule. That is, if the item in the food were artificial, something unrelated to the food, it was clearly defective and you could recover and win. But if it were natural, you could not. But this natural artificial rule isn't exactly perfect. This woman was eating a fried chicken wing, and in the process of eating this fried chicken wing, she bit into something that seemed really strange and gross, and she thought it was a worm. She was very upset and sued. Well, it turned out it was probably a piece of the chicken's aorta, you know, the large blood vessel that runs to the heart. I don't know what that was doing out in the wing, but somehow it got in there and got fried up. And she was not, this distressed her considerably, and she sued. Well, under the natural artificial rule, of course, she'd automatically lose, because a chicken aorta, whatever you think about it, is pretty natural in chickens. If they didn't have them, they wouldn't have wings either. But the court said, no, we think this is enough evidence of a defect that you can go to trial. We should let you go to trial. Okay, how about this? 18-year-old college freshman buys a bottle of tequila. This happens a lot, you people. Send your kids off to college. You got to be careful. You know, they sort of want to learn things on their own. She buys a bottle of tequila, and she decides that tastes good or something. At any rate, she downs a lot of shots of this tequila. And if you take enough alcohol in a short enough time, there is a disease of alcohol poisoning, which will just kill you. It will just kill you. I mean, not unsafe driving, but the alcohol itself will kill you. And this is what happened to her. She died of acute alcohol poisoning. Her family sued the manufacturer of the tequila for strict product liability. Well, what was the problem here? Was there a defect? What kind of a defect was there? I mean, the defect was that it was alcoholic, right? But that's the purpose of the product. Suing an alcoholic beverage manufacturer for an alcoholic product is not unlike suing a knife for it being sharp. But they had a theory, and though they failed to warn. There was a failure to warn on the alcohol bottle that this could happen. And what do you think? Do you think that the manufacturer should be liable for failure to warn? The manufacturer's main response was that the dangers of alcohol are common knowledge. We don't have to warn about something that is widely known. The court said maybe. The court wasn't. She said it's a debatable issue of fact. It is true that people generally know you shouldn't drink too much alcohol, but they may not know that specifically. They may not know why. Some people may be unaware that while alcohol is generally dangerous, some people may be unaware that can kill you from acute alcohol poisoning. What's more, an 18-year-old may be particularly unaware of this fact. But the court said itself did not want to resolve the issue either way. It said it's up for a jury to decide. In our system, we basically leave to juries the decision of fact, whether there was a real duty to warn here. And they said it's up to a jury to decide. So that's the sort of debatable case that could go either way, and the sides would have to present both of their cases to a jury. Well, I'm out of time. Thank you on product liability.